Immagini in movimento, opzione del silenzio che lo avvicina al cinema delle origini. Assenza di una narrativa riconoscibile, pulizia formale e allestitiva, modernità e modernismo, pratica e teoria dell'arte. Di questo e di molto altro abbiamo parlato con Mark Lewis, l'artista canadese che quest'anno ha rappresentato il suo paese alla Biennale di Venezia e che dopo la prima tappa italiana al Man di Nuoro arriva a Firenze, al Museo Marino Marini, per una personale che raccoglie le opere degli ultimi 10 anni.
Strange because I know that I say that I prefer to show my films in the spaces that, like other works of art, because I don't like a lot this kind of ceremonial theatrical presentation of film in galleries where you make the room black and you make a kind of cinema within the gallery space, because I find that a very kind of mannerist form that seems to reduce all film works to the status of a kind of installation, you know, that makes them appear to be like, you know, ready, cinematic ready-mades or cinematic surrogate forms, you know, that you're making a kind of, you know, like a kind of traditional avant-garde gesture in relationship to the material, so that everything about the film is then included, like the projector and the ambience and the... It's so obvious to me that the only thing I'm interested in is the image, you know. I'm only interested in the picture that I make. I'm not interested in the installation form. You know, you have to have a projector because that's how films are shown, but I don't ever consider the projector to be part of my work or you know, or the room. You know, I try to think of the film as just like a photograph or a painting, that it has a kind of status, it's autonomous, it's contained, and you know, and in theory it should stand in relationship to other works of art that have the same kind of very traditional gestures of autonomy and singularity, let's say. So the whole installation idiom, the whole idea that the cinema is ready-made, is something I'm not interested in at all. I don't mind looking at other people's work, but it's not my project. So having said that, then how do you show the work in a way which doesn't, which frees it from this kind of very, very, not relatively recent, but nevertheless a history of legibility? And the answer would be to show it like you would show any other work, any other picture work, because obviously I think of myself as making moving pictures rather than as making cinema, which may be, you know, semantics, but I think it's always been an important in my head that I'm not making cinema, you know. And therefore, you know, to have a white room with relative light gives the viewer the mobility and the flexibility to look at the work in a very free way, not in a way that's contained by the installation, because installation film art, you know, imposes a kind of way of looking. In a very traditional, old-fashioned way, I think, in, you know, in picture making, the most important part of the work is the way in which the viewer has complete freedom to engage in the work as he or she wants to, in a completely free way. And to be able to move from one work to another, to be able to stop, to be able to talk, to be able to remake the work as if you were like an artist, but not subjected by the work, but to become free and to become almost the artist of the work. And those things are difficult in the dark, and they're difficult when there's loud sound, and it's difficult when the space is very theatrical. So white rooms, relative light, all these things are great. They help the spectator feel free and to feel as if, you know, it's not a theatrical experience. So that's the theory, you know. Unfortunately, the practice is that films look better the darker the room, you know. That's just, you know, a fact of life. You have a dark room, a film looks better than a light room. So it's nice. So this is a long, rambling way to say that seeing the works in a dark space is kind of nice, because I now can look at the works in a way which they're not normally seen. And you actually see much better color, much better contrast, all the things that, in a way, are denuded or made compromised by having the kind of typical installation that I do. So the answer is, it's interesting to see it in a space like that. I'm not sure I would do it every time, but there is an advantage. As I said to my friend yesterday, in the end, films look better in the dark. In the end, art looks better when it's not dark. All I wanted to do in Venice was to show my work the way I normally show it. I tried to treat the occasion like just a normal exhibition. I just thought, I got selected to be in Venice on the basis of this, the kind of work I do. So therefore I'm going to show the kind of work I do. I'm not going to make an installation. I'm not going to do something special. I'm not going to make a kind of big statement or a big project. I'm just going to show four recent films. And that was my idea, just to show the last four films four of the last five or six films that I'd made. I mean, obviously when I was making the films, I knew that they were going to go there, but I tried to think of them as being independent and that they could be shown anywhere. The idea was to have no installation whatsoever. It was to try and show the films as if you went to a gallery and saw my work. That's why I don't think it worked, because I think the space is too small for the number of films I showed. I think I made a mistake. I think I showed too many. I think that the architecture is so imposing of the building that obviously people like you or other people make connections between the architecture of the building and the architecture that my work depicts. So in a way, no, I don't think there's any relationship between the building and my work, but unfortunately it seems that there is. Well, Venice had particular problems, you know, from the building, which is really a difficult building. It's a beautiful building, but maybe not such a beautiful building for showing art, but it's definitely a very interesting building. But having so much glass makes it difficult to show film, and since I show film, I had to deal with that problem. I think historically the artists from film artists that have shown film there have basically blacked out the building. You know, Janet Cardiff made a space within a space, and Rodney Graham kept the wooden cover so you didn't, there was basically covered it, basically to negate the space, to create a kind of alternative space within the space. And that was obviously an option, but I decided that I wanted to try and keep the space, you know, because that is the space. So maybe it was possible to show the works the way I like to show them, which is in relative light, and keep the transparency. So that's what we did. I worked with these architects and we came up with a kind of plan to cover the glass with like automotive film, to darken it, to maintain the transparency so you could see out, even you could see in a bit and still see the works. In the end, I don't think it was very successful. You know, I have to say, I didn't think it really worked so well. Going back to what we just talked about at the beginning, I think that whole idiom, if you like, of showing the projector and having a kind of historical presence of the cinema in the room, I think is part of this avant-garde strategy of the ready-made. You're bringing this kind of whole institutional apparatus into the gallery as a kind of artifact to re-engage it in a new story or a new narrative. And so when you go into installation of artists, you know, like for instance Tacita Dean or someone like this, you really feel the presence of the 16mm projector. You hear it, as you say, and there's a kind of nostalgic relationship to a particular moment in history when this sound was very familiar. And of course the sound is disappearing because of the new technologies now. Films are shown digitally mainly, or more and more, and so on and so forth. But all I can say is that I really have a very simple, ordinary idea, and that's I'm interested in depiction, you know, and how to make a picture of something. And then having said that, how to make a picture of something that moves. And to me, the history of picture making is not about sound. It's about a pictorial space, and sound doesn't belong to that space. Sound belongs to something else. And you could say, if you could excuse me for being a bit pedantic or dogmatic, you know, sound doesn't really belong in art. You know, sound belongs in concert halls, in theater, in cinema, but doesn't really belong in art. It's a kind of, you could say it's a little bit of an ugly intrusion into the space of pictorial contemplation. I mean, obviously that's a very conservative view, and it's obviously not true, because, you know, so many artists have worked with sound. But what I like about picture making is that historically, you know, picture makers, painters have had to work with sound in the same way they had to work with movement, without being able to make a sound, without being able to move. So they had to incorporate something of the feeling of sound or the feeling of movement and time without actually being able to do it. So there was a sublimation of that experience into another form. And I think that's always been an exciting way to think about how the picture can give you a sense of sound without it actually having material sound. So I always think of my films as being full of sound, because when I think about them, I think about the sound when I'm in the location. I think of, you know, for instance, if I'm making a film in, you know, like Algonquin Park, early March, I think about the, you know, the sound of the wind, of the trees moving, of the voices of the children as they're skating. All of these things are kind of in my head. And I think that they, if the work is successful, it can give a sense of that sound without the sound actually being there. The problem with sound being there is that it, as you know, sound is so dominant, it can overwhelm the experience of looking at something if you have sound. I mean, it depends on what sound, of course, but much sound has the effect of silencing the viewer. You know, not only can it make it difficult to speak, but it can also make it difficult to think, you know, because you're being kind of silenced by this material, which is very unforgiving. I mean, the great thing about a picture is that when you want to stop looking, you just turn away. The problem with sound is you actually have to leave. You have to leave the place. You can't suddenly decide to stop listening. It's always there. So, my decision to not use sound is really, I think, it's a decision not about absence, but about a decision not to add. I always think my works are not. Are not without sound. They just don't have sound added. You know, I could add sound if I want to, but I decided not to. The experience of modernism, if you like, or to think through the work of art in terms of material specificity, is that what is it that is specific to the film experience, which doesn't belong to anything else? Is that what you're suggesting? In which case, sound is something that is not part of film. It doesn't belong to film. In the very early days of film, there was no sound. Sound was eventually added to film in order to make it more theatrical, you know, to make it tell a story. And often a story that is not added on and is not actually essentially in the material itself. So from that point of view, you could say that sound is not proper to film. It's a kind of montage that is created by addition, by design. One of the things that I like to think about my own work is that I don't really conceptualize it. I mean, I try to imagine that my films are only what... I mean, of course, I'm being a little, you know, dogmatic and pedantic, but I try to imagine that my films are only about what the camera can see. So it's not what I can see, but what the camera can see, and therefore the camera can't hear anything. Therefore, it doesn't belong. And of course, you could argue that video and all these other forms that have sound already integrated in the material. But in a way, they were designed in order to approximate this montage that had already been theatrically introduced. I'm not trying to be coy. But I think my work is incredibly simple. I think what you see is all there is. There's nothing else. I mean, of course, there are many, many things because I'm a picture maker, I make films, I'm interested in images, I'm interested in art, but so are viewers. I'm interested in the cinema, I'm interested in images I see in the street, but so are you. I mean, we're all interested in that. And not only are we interested in it, we can't get away from it. Part of the way in which we understand, that's the great thing of working with images is that every image quotes another image. And what I love most about working in film and in photography or whatever is what I think of as the quotational life of pictures, that they have their own life. They quote other pictures without me being involved in that process. Do you know what I'm saying? So that every picture has a kind of quotational history. It's a kind of essential characteristic of pictures, is that every picture quotes every other picture that's ever made in some strange way. And obviously it'll quote other pictures more strongly than others. I really, really try not to work in a quotational way. I try really never to think of another film or another picture when I'm making a film or a picture, because I think that is the only way in which the real quotations can happen, which is the force of quotation which belongs to the picture not to me. So that if I make a kind of direct quotation of a painting, let's say, in a way that stops the film or from doing its own work. So, you know, people write about my work a lot as quoting other paintings, but I never think of other paintings when I make my films. I try never to think of that. For instance, the film Algonquin Park, early March, you know, the winter, people talk about, you know, Bruegel and Malevich, and they talk about the whole history of painting in that time. But, you know, I can tell you the only thing that I thought about when I made that film was the experience of standing on that place and seeing this illusion. That's the only thing I thought about. And then I had a kind of hallucination when I was up there. It's a very isolated spot, and I was alone. It's a little dangerous in the winter, and a very loud wind. And I had a hallucination when I was a child, a young boy, when we used to drive up north when I lived in Canada, and we would go to a frozen lake, and the teacher or some father would make a kind of small rink for skating on. And I remembered that, and I thought, I want to make this here. And that's the only thing I thought about. I didn't think of anything to do with the history of painting. Although, of course, I know very much the history of painting because I love painting. So I spend a lot of time looking at paintings. I write about paintings. You know, it's part of my life. You know, it's my passion. But I try not to think about these things when I'm making work. I try to think about only what the camera can see. I realize that I'm being a little bit coy and it's not really true, but that's really the kind of structure that I work with, to try and eliminate all what you were saying before, to try and eliminate everything except what is proper to this place and to this camera and to this experience. If I'm lucky, then the works will make those connections for you, not because I put them in there, but because the works themselves have that power, or all images have that power to quote other pictures. It's inevitable that every picture will become part of the history of pictures. Therefore, it's essential to their material specificity that they will make this quotation for you. But they will only make this quotation for you if I refuse to make the quotation for it. Does that make sense? One of the great disappointments of working in film is this sense of evanescence, you know, the disappearance of things. You know, if you think of the classic 25 frames a second, every film is a kind of iconoclastic machine destroying the previous image. So you have this kind of constant destruction of one image by the next. So you never actually have the image there. It's always disappearing. It's a great disappointment, you know. It's why film in the end can never be a picture, because it's a picture destroyer, not a picture. Its process is to destroy pictures in a way. And some people argue, to be very formal about it and very specific, people like Michael Fried would argue that the problem with film is that its time is too close, is because the time of film is the same time as real time. It can never really be a proper modern work of art because it doesn't stop. One could argue is that the part of the experience of the work of art is the dialectic between the image that doesn't move and the person that does, you know, so that you have this kind of difference or this kind of dissonance between these two times. And in film, the time of film is the same as the time of life, so you don't have this dissonance, you don't have this kind of dialectic, if you like. I always experience that as a disappointment. I mean, for instance, talking about the same film that we just talked about, Algonquin Park, Ringling Brook, you know, which I hate watching it sometimes. It's disappointing to watch it always disappearing, to never have a chance to see the picture. It's always changing, and I find that very... But that's also what's interesting about it, you know. If you're going to make a film that has a relationship to picture making, then you have to deal with the specificity, which is that it can't be a picture. So it's this relationship between wanting to be a picture and not being able to be a picture that I find exciting as well as disappointing. So the newest film in this show, which is the one of the gypsies in the old football field, it holds, I think, for like 2 minutes maybe before it starts to move. It's really difficult to know how long to hold it, because, you know, the temptation is always, you know, when I'm making the film, or of course when I'm editing it, I can cut it, is that I'm holding it too long. You know, something should happen. I kind of learned to fight that, you know, to fight the expectancy, you know, because I think, I guess a good question is, how long can I hold this shot before it moves? That's sort of a question that I would ask myself. I think it's about trying to eke out, to try and find a very, very specific space that exists between a picture and a film. You know, that what is the kind of absolute essential difference between the two? And can you find a balance which is almost impossible to sustain? You know, for instance, many people might leave the film, like saying this film or Algonquin Park, Early March, they might leave because nothing's happening, and they'll walk out, which is fine. Of course, if I saw it, I would feel disappointed to see people were walking out, but I know it happens. And so my question is, you know, how long can I hold it before somebody will start to experience what they first think is boring, which is what I do. This is boring. And when the whole concept or the whole idea of boredom becomes in itself kind of a corporal experience, like where you begin to feel it as a kind of bodily form, you know, where you begin to feel, well, boredom is actually 99% of daily life, right? You know, I mean, one only has a few seconds of non-boredom a day, you know. You know what I'm saying? It's like the experience of doing nothing is really the experience of life. So, as I said before, I never really think about these things, but if I'm thinking about it now, the idea that one would want to kind of calculate the liminal moment of when boredom becomes exciting, you know, when boredom flips into its opposite. I mean, that's sort of what that's about. The origins of film are single shots, right? I mean, the Lumiere brothers, the Frères Lumiere, it's one shot, 1 minute. You know, the decision for how long the film was going to be was because the piece of film was that long. So that's how they made that decision. And so I like that. So I've often used that as a kind of way of working. I mean, I almost start every film with the idea that it will be about 4 minutes. Maybe it'll end up being 2 minutes, maybe it'll end up being 6 minutes, but I kind of think that 4 minutes is a perfect length for me to think about. And the reason for that was that I used to shoot most of my films in 35mm, and, you know, that comes in 4 minute rolls, or it comes in 10 minute rolls, and it comes in 4 minute rolls commercially. So I thought, well, 4 minute rule seems about the right length, you know. One of the things that I don't like about video art is that it's too long usually, you know. I mean, you mentioned earlier a piece that was 30 or 40 minutes long. I mean, to me, that's just so long, you know. I mean, I couldn't bear it. Having said that, I made a 40-minute film that I'm actually showing here. So I actually have made a longer film, but that's for the cinema. I try to make films that are the appropriate length for the spaces they're in. If I can be, again, a little bit pedantic. But so in a gallery, 4 minutes, 2 minutes, 6 minutes, 1 minute, these are appropriate lengths to stand and to experience. I think a 40-minute, 20-minute, 60-minute, these are inappropriate lengths. I mean, of course, endurance is interesting as well. So I'm not, you know, there's exceptions to every rule. And sometimes to watch, you know, in a gallery to see Empire, you know, that's an endurance. And it's kind of, you hallucinate, you fantasy, you fall asleep, you go. That's whole part of the experience, and that makes it interesting. But generally speaking, a rule for me is that it should be appropriate to the space. So to stand in a space and to look at a wall, 40 minutes is too long. You know, it's just impossible for the body to experience something in that way. I mean, but the other film you talk about, Backstory, this is made for the cinema. So, you know, the cinema can, you can sit, you can, you know, it's comfortable and you can watch it. So the longer length is more appropriate for that space. So, and then that film has sound. So again, the cinema is a good place for sound as well. But I like what your question was before about how our expectations and experience of looking at film and video in the gallery are overdetermined in part by our experience of the cinema. And although the cinema started with long takes, we could say that now the cinema, the long take is, except in, you know, what we call art cinema, the long tape has disappeared. I mean, you know, I think someone said the average length of a shot in a Hollywood movie now is like, you know, is like 3/4 of a second or 1.2 seconds, you know. So I have a really great friend who's works in Los Angeles. He's one of the top cinematographers now. He does, you know, really huge movies, and he made this film called, you know, did you see Dreamgirls? So he made that film. He's just a cinematographer, and he, you know, he's really, you know, amazing cinematographer. He spends so much time carefully composing the picture, making sure the light is perfect, and then the disappointment when he goes to see the movie, that a shot that took him 4 hours to make only lasts 1 second on the screen, and no one has time to look at it because the story is just, it's always moving. And my experience of watching commercial movies is that there are so many films that have such great experiences of the visual that never last long enough for me to understand it, and it's always a sense of disappointment. So I try to work against that. I try to think about how you can make an image last long enough so that you can, that the viewer can start to not only to feel endurance. I mean, they're not 90 minutes long or 24 hours long even, but that you can start to experience the image as an image and take control of it, you know, and begin to own it, you know. But in a movie, most movies, the viewer never owns the picture because the story is so possessive, you know, that it can't bear to have an image up long enough. And that's what I was saying to you before, you know, like the images have this life, you know, they have their own life, and you have to let that life reveal itself, and you can't control it. There's several things I would want to say. First of all, is I'm always worried that I'm attracted sort of preternaturally to the ruin, like anybody. There's something kind of maudlin and romantic, and the ruin can be kind of like a solipsistic allegory of one's own, you know, mortality, and I hate all that. I don't like the idea that that would become a kind of topic or an idea that my work would be about. So I always find myself shocked by how many of my works have modernist buildings that are in some one form or another are in a state of disrepair. As someone also told me once, that so many of the buildings that I shoot, even if they're not a ruin now, disappear later. So he said that never, you know, he would never let me shoot his house because he'd be worried that it was gonna get destroyed later. So this worries me, and in that text I wrote for the Documenta book, I tried to think about why it is that I'm also drawn, you know, I mean, of course, I'm no different for anyone else. I'm drawn to it for the same romantic and ideas as anyone else, so it's not special. But I also wanted to find out if there was a way in which one could resist that and still reveal something, or still have a kind of material relationship to the form without being trapped in the nostalgic, romantic stories and so on. That's a kind of personal problem, you know, always to try and not do that, but then inevitably, when you know, I find myself doing it anyway. In response to what you're saying about artists or people interested in the destruction of modernist buildings, is that maybe there's something particular about the destruction now, because development is, you know, capitalist development is very rapacious and massive now, and perhaps there are more people, there's more industry, there's more development, there's more buildings. But every age destroys significant amounts of its history. We're in a city that has a small part that is more than other cities, of course, has a small part that's being maintained. But there are many, many buildings that were built here that have gone, that were that were destroyed in the 18th century, in the 17th century, in the 16th century. You know, it's natural that every age will destroy a significant proportion of its own immediate prehistory. I don't think our relationship to the modern forms is any more iconoclastic than any other age. You know, it just is that maybe the development of capital now is bigger, therefore more gets torn down. But I think it's just a kind of natural montage of you know. So I wrote a text for Documenta, and I tried to understand what that problem was, and I don't think I ever did. So, because I had the feeling that when Roger Bruegel and Ruth Nowak were the curators of Documenta, when they were formulating this idea of modernity and antiquity, that they repeated, as we all do, this kind of slippage between, as you've just indicated, between modernity and modernism, between the idea of the modern and the idea of art as a kind of attitude in art that in some sense a response to modernity, but is not necessarily simultaneous to the idea of modernity. So I tried to understand, when I wrote that, what it could possibly be, what the difference could be, and how these two terms both nominate the same thing and don't. And I don't think I did, because I think you're right. It's a constant slippage between the two. Even as you try to hold one separate from the other, they kind of start to slide into each other. I don't think of modernism or modernity as a ruin. You see, that's what I tried to... I didn't think I understood. I don't think it is a ruin. I think it is a kind of mnemonic trace that exacts meaning and interpretation and quotation in a very, very lively way. I think the problem with the ruin is a kind of fixed form. It's a form of antiquity, of course, but it's a form of closure and of total knowledge and refusal to engage. It's interesting, but it's not fascinating. The strangeness of it now is what's the French guy, I've forgotten, he talks about it. The shocking thing about the modern is that it starts to look as if it belongs to another age. It's a kind of liminal moment as the signs of the modern start to look a little bit alienated, like we don't quite understand them anymore. Because it's not a ruin. It's in a process of being forgotten. It's in the process of, or let's say, its intentionality and its origins and its motivation and its utopian desire are in the process of being forgotten, but they're not yet forgotten. They're in this kind of stage of where you don't quite understand it, but you still have a sense that it belongs to you. When I went to art school and university, it was really the height of this fanatic relationship to theory. We had to read all this stuff, you know, in philosophy and psychoanalysis and all that stuff, and I think this was really crazy, to my opinion. I had to read it, I read it, I got completely engaged in it. I didn't understand anything, but it was all part of the atmosphere of the time, and I think it produced some pretty bad art, in my opinion, including my own at the time, because it became work that was driven by an idea, driven by a kind of theoretical project to reveal some truth that was already understood in some way. So I think I became a better artist once I stopped thinking about it myself. I mean, but that what I mean by that is I stopped thinking about how I could make pictures of some idea that I'd read about. Or I think that really trapped me in a very kind of pedantic and a very dogmatic way of working. But I think it's really important for artists to have history, you know, and to have knowledge about what they make and about the history of other art and about, you know, to be part of life. When I hear the word theory, I think of this moment in my own education when we had to read Lacan and Derrida and, you know, Foucault and Lyotard. And why? You know, I never read it now. I never look at that stuff now. I mean, I can barely understand it, you know, when I read it. It's written in a... I mean, sometimes there are little things that are interesting. I mean, I guess if you read it like, you know, like Walter Benjamin, you can read it, you know, as a kind of collage of ideas, and some ideas you understand and some you don't. As you get older and busier, you have less time to read, which is a real tragedy, you know. I read almost nothing now, just because, I mean, of course I read, but I mean, compared to what I used to read, I read almost nothing because I don't have time, because life just gets fuller, right? You have family, you have a job, you make art, you know, you just have so much, your time is so limited. And I look back on those days when you're a student and you can just sit around and read. It's fantastic. But I think what's more interesting is to be driven by curiosity. So the things that I read are just because I'm curious. And I may understand nothing about the history of that text or about the background, but it's something in it there for me that's just I'm curious about. And I think that's the only thing I can say, is that curiosity is the only thing that keeps me going, you know, because if, you know, I don't have a... I just pick up a book in a bookstore and read it, and because it looks interesting, and that might be the book that makes me think about something, you know. I'm right now working on a script for a longer film, so I'm reading the same short story 50 times. I bought a story. I'm trying to turn it into a film. So I must have read that. It's only 18 pages, but I must have read it 50 times. So that's the last I read that again on the plane here. But I should also say, on After All, we have a real... I don't actively edit the magazine anymore. New people do it now. The project that I am most involved with is, I don't know if you know, books called We Do Books as well. And there's one book series called One Work. So that's really my project. And we have, you know, 10 people now at After All. So there are lots of different people that are working. We have new people who are editing the journal, and it's great because there are whole new voices, and they see much more art than me, and they read more, and you know, they're much more engaged. So, but I have to say that one of the tensions in our, and it's been a useful tension, between Charles and I, Charles Escher, who I founded the project with, is that I've always been much more formal, if I can use that word. I'm much more interested in what you see and the thing itself, and he's always been a little bit more interested in the context and in the critical ideas that inform it. And this has always been a tension between us. And when I teach, and I don't teach at all anymore, or very little, I always try to get the students to actually not bring any ideas to the work at all, just to look at the work and see what the work is, and if an idea is there, it has to be there in the work. It can't be brought extraneously. At the end of the day, I think the work is a very small, modest thing. You know, it's not capable of speaking to the history of ideas. It's only capable of speaking to very, very simple things. And it's those simple things that allow, going back to what we were saying before, that allow you to think about more complex things, right? It allows you to make a kind of bigger idea, but the work itself is very modest and very simple. And so if I was the owner of the magazine and it was my private magazine, which it isn't, thank God, it'd be less about ideas and more about the material and more about the thing itself, because I think that's all that I'm interested in.
Radio Papesse è un progetto di Ilaria Gadens, Carola Haupt e Cristiano Maggi.